Welcome, everyone, to The Deep Dive. I'm Lee Graham, your guide, and today we're really plunging into a stack of fresh sources that landed on our desk. Get ready for The Washington Post for Sunday, September 14th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Hurst, here to help unpack these stories, connect the dots, and really dig into the broader implications of what's making headlines.
Our mission for you today is a deep exploration. We've got, well, an incredibly rich collection of articles spanning the shifting landscapes of politics, the economy, global affairs, groundbreaking technology, intriguing cultural shifts, and the always captivating world of sports.
Yeah, it's quite a mix.
That is. Our goal isn't just to tell you what happened, but to extract those, you know, most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from each piece, give you a real shortcut to being thoroughly well-informed and perhaps even a little surprised by what we uncover.
That's right. We're looking beyond the surface, delving into the nuances, and discussing the lasting impact and significance of each story. We want you to walk away understanding not just the facts, but why these events matter and what they could, you know, mean for the future.
Exactly.
We're going to navigate this comprehensive report together as if you're right here with us in the studio. So let's begin our deep dive.
All right. Let's kick things off with our first segment focusing on domestic issues and a truly seismic event that has reshaped the political conversation recently. We're starting with extensive coverage surrounding the conservative activist, Charlie Kirk. Mm-hmm. He was tragically shot and killed on a Utah college campus. The Washington Post dedicates significant space to his life, his organization, Turning Point, and of course, the ripple effects of his sudden death.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate the impact of the story. What immediately strikes me is how the article, The Building of a Juggernaut, portrays Kirk. I mean, at just 31, he wasn't just a voice. He, like, built a modern political organization, Turning Point USA, uniquely suited for the social media age.
Right, he really understood that landscape.
Absolutely. He mastered online discourse and, well, Discord. He was known for presenting incredibly provocative views with an almost disarming calmness, often, you know, with a smile. This unusual combination, as the piece explains, paradoxically attracted a huge Gen Z audience, even as his critics frequently accused him of sexism or racism.
And his viral reach was just undeniable, wasn't it? The article mentions a video where he advised Taylor Swift to reject feminism and submit to your husband.
Right, I remember that one.
That clip alone garnered an astonishing 7.5 million views on TikTok. He clearly understood how to tap into and even amplify the culture wars. He even waded into controversial areas like diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI initiatives. Mm. For example, regarding United Airlines pilot program, where he argued DEI invites unwholesome thinking. It was just a constant stream of highly charged, attention-grabbing commentary.
Absolutely. And if we zoom out a bit, Kirk's approach was truly at the vanguard of a new generation of political influencers who really exploded during the Trump era. They built massive online audiences by expertly fighting culture wars with language designed for maximum engagement, for virality.
Yeah, designed to be clipped and shared.
Exactly. Turning Point, his organization, racked up billions of social media views, and it's even credited with boosting youth turnout for Donald Trump back in 2024 and financially. It was a powerhouse, taking in over $90 million last year.
Wow.
That's a significant indicator of its influence on the Republican Party's strategy for young voters. A huge influence.
The article also points out his willingness to debate anyone, anywhere, which was a core part of his appeal, right?
Definitely.
Clips from his campus appearances weren't just shared. They became the message in many ways. It's telling that even political opponents like California Governor Gavin Newsom acknowledged his impact, inviting Kirk as the very first guest on his podcast.
That's fascinating.
And the piece notes that liberal groups actively studied his tactics. That tells you just how effective his model was, regardless of, you know, your stance on his message.
It really forces us to consider the evolving nature of political engagement today. Kirk's last social media post, made just hours before his death, perfectly exemplifies the highly charged and often polarizing nature of his activism. He explicitly declared it was 100% necessary to politicize the killing of Irina Zaritska, a Ukrainian refugee in Charlotte.
Right, linking it directly to Democratic policies.
Directly. And this was done even as the victim's own family publicly pleaded for people to stop circulating the video of her death. It shows an extreme readiness to connect any event to a political agenda, often, it seems, without regard for the human sensitivities involved.
The ripple effects of his death were immediate and, for many, quite personal. Another article details how the aftermath became a kind of litmus test in the workplace. Mm. reactions to his killing, whether expressed publicly or even in, you know, seemingly private forums, quickly became a measure of employers' tolerance for political speech.
Yeah, that piece was striking.
Within a mere 24 hours, individuals across various sectors, an assistant dean at a Tennessee college, an NFL communications staffer, an Office Depot employee, among others, were fired or suspended for posts deemed offensive or insensitive about Kirk. It's a very stark example of the immediate fallout.
A key detail that truly stands out here is the intense tension between employees' fundamental right to free speech and employers' equally crucial need to protect their reputations and maintain a civil, functioning environment. The case of the assistant dean at Middle Tennessee State University, Laura Soschleitze, is a vivid example.
Right, the hate begets hate post.
Exactly. She was terminated for that Facebook post stating, "Hate begets hate, zero sympathy." This incident, and many others like it, force a reevaluation of where the line is drawn for political expression in the workplace, particularly during emotionally charged events. And what are the broader implications for employment law and corporate culture in an increasingly polarized society?
And the gravity of the situation extends beyond individual workplaces. Another piece, Kirk's Killing and Aftermath, or Symptoms of a Fragile Democracy, delivers a really stark warning. Utah Governor Spencer Cox is quoted as saying that this rising tide of politically motivated violence is, quote, an attack on the American experiment.
Strong words.
Very. In an environment already thick with escalating tensions, that context is just vital for understanding how serious this feels to many people.
Indeed. And Karen Tumulty's opinion piece echoes this, emphasizing that the country's democratic system appears more fragile than at any point in living memory. She points to a rising tide of violence across ideological lines. Governor Cox didn't mince words, calling Kirk's murder much bigger than an attack on an individual. It is an attack on all of us.
Mm-hmm.
He posed the crucial question, this is our moment. Do we escalate or do we find an off-ramp? Highlighting the critical choice facing the nation in the wake of such a deeply divisive event.
The article connects this fragility to the broader political landscape, notably the upcoming midterm elections, where historically the party in the White House almost always loses seats. It also references Stacey Abrams' national campaign.
Right, arguing the guardrails are already crumbling.
Exactly, arguing that democracy's guardrails are already crumbling and that authoritarianism settles in gradually. Her campaign suggests that if we perceive this moment as anything less than an existential fight, we're fundamentally misreading the danger.
The profound implication here is how each side, viewing the other as an existential threat, or, you know, in former President Trump's words, the enemy from within, provides a dangerous rationale for violent action for those who are, as the article puts it, unbalanced.
It's a justification, almost.
It can be twisted that way. The piece also notes a distressing lack of unifying political leaders in the current environment, drawing a sharp contrast with President Bill Clinton's powerful speech after the Oklahoma City bombing, which actively sought to marginalize extremists. This really forces us to consider what kind of leadership is desperately needed in a deeply polarized era to pull the country back from the brink.
And bringing a global perspective to this, global right reacts with grief and anger to the killing of Kirk. Shows his influence extended far beyond the U.S. leaders, like Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu were among those expressing condolences.
Yeah, that was notable.
Clearly highlighting Kirk's significant connections to a global nationalist right movement.
This is truly remarkable because it illustrates the internationalization of these conservative movements. Orban openly blamed the hate-mongering left for Kirk's death, while Netanyahu called Kirk a once-in-a-generation figure who defended common Judeo-Christian civilization. He even read from a letter Kirk had written him expressing support for Israel. The article details Kirk's recent trips to Japan and South Korea, where he spoke enthusiastically about high-trust societies and found his anti-immigration messages resonating. He even saw a growing conservative movement in the UK, strikingly similar to pre-Trump America. It indicates a widespread ideological alignment across continents, suggesting a global network operating on shared principles, often around nationalism and immigration.
Okay, moving on, let's look at several articles detailing the Trump administration's domestic actions, beginning with a deep dive into the D.C. crime crackdown. Snapshot emerging in Trump's D.C. sweep analyzes 12,273 arrest records from the first 4 weeks,
right,
giving us an on-the-ground view of how this police surge actually played out on the city's streets.
A key detail that really jumped out to me here is the granular data revealed by the Post's analysis. Over a third of those 12,273 arrests involved federal law enforcement, and they were heavily concentrated in the city's poorest, least white, and most crime-riddled neighborhoods.
But not exclusively, right?
No, exactly. The article also notes that a significant number of arrests occurred in highly visible, often low-crime areas like the National Mall and near the White House areas, frequented by the president and tourists. While the White House was quick to tout the operation's success in driving down crime and seizing illegal guns, this analysis offers a more nuanced, at times kind of troubling view of its execution.
Beyond just local police and federal agents, the report notes that hundreds of people suspected of being in the country illegally were arrested by federal immigration agents. According to the White House's own tally, this accounted for about 41% of all arrests during the month-long crackdown.
That's a huge percentage.
It is. The article points out the difficulty in tracing these specific cases and explicitly excludes juvenile arrests and domestic violence cases, which means the full scope of the sweep is likely even wider than this data suggests.
This really forces us to consider the methods used during the crackdown. Many arrests, the records show, began with officers approaching suspects for nonviolent offenses, like tinted car windows or expired tags.
Pretext stops.
Right, tactics often referred to as pretext stops, where a minor offense is used as a reason to investigate for more serious crimes. U.S. Park Police, for example, initiated at least 10 car chases that would have violated D.C. police policy, with six of those chases resulting in crashes.
Wow, crashes.
Yeah. Even more concerning, prosecutors have dismissed some gun cases, citing a lack of adequate cause for the initial stop or arrest, indicating potential legal challenges to these tactics.
But the article also presents different perspectives reflecting the deep divisions on this issue. Ward 8 Commissioner Salima Dofo, for instance, voiced worries about human and civil rights violations. Yet other residents, like Astor Endemical, whose building tragically saw a homicide, supported the intervention, stating unequivocally that public safety has to be number one.
A difficult balance.
And a police advocate, Jason Johnson, even heralded these pretext stops as one of the most powerful tools available to officers, arguing they help prevent tragedy. It's a clear tension between individual rights and public safety concerns.
Looking at the wider context, another Ward 8 commissioner, Randall Strickland, argues that these interventions only defer and displace crime rather than addressing the fundamental root causes, which he attributes to social and economic conditions.
Right, pushing the problem elsewhere.
That's his argument. He expresses deep concern that young Black and brown individuals in these communities feel even more targeted by a federalized police presence. This highlights a fundamental divide in how crime and public safety are understood and addressed. One side focusing primarily on enforcement, the other advocating for deeper societal and economic solutions.
Closely related to the D.C. crackdown is Louisiana cities could see 1,000 from Guard, detailing a proposal to activate 1,000 Louisiana National Guard troops for law enforcement missions in urban centers across the state. This represents a significant potential expansion of military involvement in domestic policing.
Yeah, a really interesting pattern of federal power may be emerging. What makes this particularly noteworthy is the proposed expansion of the military's role in policing American citizens, potentially going beyond traditional support functions to maybe even include arrest authority.
That's the key question, isn't it? Arrest authority.
It is. This plan, meticulously outlined in Pentagon planning documents, appears to have originated with Elbridge Colby, a Trump political appointee overseeing Pentagon policy. It draws clear parallels to the D.C. deployment, where 2,300 National Guard troops are currently assisting. But here's the crucial distinction. In D.C., the Guard is explicitly not authorized to make arrests.
Right.
The Louisiana plan, however, doesn't specify whether these guard troops would be granted arrest authority. This forces us to consider federal overreach and states' rights, especially when the military steps into civilian law enforcement roles. Big questions there.
And speaking of federal actions, GOP needs to sell its big bill to voters, but Trump has been missing from the push. Reveals a significant political challenge for Republicans. They openly acknowledge that voters, well, they have no idea what's actually in their landmark One Big Beautiful Bill Act, despite its sweeping nature.
A key takeaway from this piece is the striking contrast with traditional presidential campaigning and the expected role of a party leader. President Trump has largely outsourced the promotion of this major legislation to Vice President J.D. Vance and other administration officials rather than actively barnstorming the nation himself.
Which is unusual.
Very unusual. The article mentions that even his allies are giving gentle nudges for him to travel more, recognizing that nothing focuses attention and potentially sways voters quite like a president traveling into a state to tout his party's policies. This strategy, or perceived lack thereof, represents a significant departure from historical norms for promoting major legislative achievements.
The White House seems to think part of the problem might even be the bill's somewhat generic name, suggesting a rebrand to something more voter-friendly, like the Working Families Tax Cut.
Maybe.
However, a review of Trump's daily schedule shows an untraditional use of presidential time, focusing more on White House events, answering press questions for extended periods, and frequent visits to his golf clubs, rather than the extensive campaign travel that would typically be expected to sell a major legislative achievement.
The profound impact this has is on Republican hopes in the 2026 midterm elections. Lawmakers like Richard Hudson and Brian Jack have openly noted the imperative of using Trump's megaphone and podium to effectively share their story and demonstrate they're delivering on his agenda.
Well, you need the messenger.
Exactly. A perceived lack of personal engagement from the top leader, especially for a bill meant to be a signature achievement, truly forces us to consider the effectiveness of political communication and voter mobilization when the message isn't consistently amplified by the most influential voice in the party.
Shifting gears to the economy, we have a critical look at the current financial landscape, with Wall Street is galloping as U.S. economy hobbles along, highlighting a truly perplexing disconnect between market performance and, well, economic fundamentals.
What's truly remarkable here is this glaring paradox. Major stock indexes like the S&P 500 have climbed steadily upward, up more than 12% on the year and sitting just shy of a record. Yet at the same time, multiple economic fundamentals have softened considerably.
Like what specifically?
Well, we're seeing unemployment rising, worker pessimism at its highest in years, inflation creeping higher at a 2.9% annual pace, the U.S. deficit climbing, and consumer sentiment on the decline. It's a disconnect that leaves many economists and everyday people, you know, scratching their heads.
Claudia Sam, chief economist for New Century Advisors, captures this paradox quite succinctly. She states, the stock market is filtering the economic data and it sees good things going forward. Households are seeing that same reality and coming down pretty pessimistic. This really highlights how different segments of the economy can perceive the exact same data in dramatically different ways. Wall Street looking ahead, maybe, while Main Street feels the pinch right now.
Analysts largely attribute the market's seemingly irrational growth in the face of worsening economic data to increased expectations that the Federal Reserve will take a more active approach to stimulating the economy, possibly by lowering interest rates as soon as next week.
Despite inflation concerns.
Despite the Fed's past reluctance to cut rates too quickly due to persistent inflation concerns, yeah. Michael Farr of Farr, Miller & Washington, a D.C.-based investment firm, warns of the danger of the market getting well ahead of what the Fed is actually saying, which he fears could lead to stupidly expensive stocks. This raises an important question about the inherent stability of market expectations when they diverge so significantly from underlying economic reality and official signals from the central bank.
An opinion piece. The economy looks weaker. The Federal Reserve looks weaker, too, elaborates on the Fed's multifaceted challenges. The job market, in particular, is showing significant weakness. A record downward revision of 911,000 jobs over the past year.
That number is just staggering, 911,000.
It is. To put that in perspective, it means the economy actually added half as many jobs as previously announced, a massive and concerning shift. And weekly unemployment benefits have spiked to 263,000, the highest since October 2021.
The most striking aspect here is the stagflation scenario presented by the article. High inflation, stubbornly above the Fed's 2% target, combined with a stagnant job market and real median income growth that actually stalled in 2024.
Not a good combination.
Not at all. The Fed faces two deeply unpleasant conundrums, whether to cut rates and risk even higher inflation or maintain them and risk further economic slowdown. It's a delicate balancing act with no easy answers, making their next move incredibly consequential.
Simultaneously, the Fed's traditional independence is under direct attack. President Trump is explicitly pushing to fire Governor Lisa Cook over unproven allegations of mortgage fraud.
Right, that's unfolding now.
And he is also actively trying to seat Stephen Miron, currently the chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, on the Fed's board in time for next week's meeting, specifically so that he can vote for a rate cut. This is a very clear and overt attempt to influence the Fed's monetary policy decisions.
It forces us to grapple with the politicization of an institution that was specifically designed to be independent of political influence. Cook has sued to keep her seat, and a federal judge has already temporarily halted her firing, calling Trump's attempt probably illegal.
But the administration appealed.
Yes, the Justice Department quickly appealed, and the dispute could potentially reach the Supreme Court. This really highlights the critical nature of maintaining the Federal Reserve's independence, especially at a time when its decisions are so crucial for a struggling economy trying to navigate persistent inflation and a weak job market.
Indeed. And Cook listed condo as a second home, files show, details the specifics of these mortgage fraud allegations against Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, providing a deeper look into the basis of the administration's claims.
The documents themselves are at the heart of these allegations, and what's particularly noteworthy is that in multiple 2021 documents, including a loan estimate and a form submitted for her nomination to the central bank, Cook described an Atlanta property as a vacation home or second home.
And the administration's argument is
President Trump is attempting to fire her for cause based on accusations she committed mortgage fraud by allegedly calling more than one home a primary residence to secure lower mortgage rates. Her financial disclosure forms show a 3.25% interest rate on the Atlanta property, which was slightly higher than prevailing rates for her primary residence at the time. So that's the core of their case.
Her lawyers argue that the administration's attempt to oust her is unprecedented and illegal, and Cook herself has stated unequivocally that she won't be bullied into leaving. The case is seen as a crucial test of the Fed's independence.
Absolutely.
With the Supreme Court potentially weighing in on the president's power to remove board members, a decision that could have far-reaching implications for the structure and autonomy of federal agencies moving forward.
The broader implication here is the significant threat to the Fed's traditional independence from political influence. This is particularly concerning at a time when its decisions on interest rates are absolutely crucial for a struggling economy. Any erosion of that independence could profoundly undermine confidence in the central bank's ability to act in the nation's best economic interest without political interference.
And Ian, Trump faces same economic challenges that cost Harris her White House bid. We see history potentially repeating itself, suggesting that the current economic climate could have significant political repercussions for the Republican Party.
A key takeaway here is the direct parallel drawn between the economic environment facing President Trump now and the one that cost Kamala Harris the White House last fall. It's described as a double whammy. Rising consumer prices up 2.9% annually, with jarring specific examples like ground beef up 13%, eggs 11%, and coffee a staggering 21%. This is coupled with an anemic job market, averaging just 29,000 jobs per month, which has driven job optimism to a record low, according to the New York Federal Reserve Bank.
Voters, according to a Fox News poll cited, have already soured on Trump's signature economic policies, including his high tariffs, with 52% saying he's made the economy worse. Claudia Sam, the economist mentioned earlier, notes that tariffs prolong somewhat higher inflation, which only exacerbates the problem for households already struggling with rising costs.
This really forces us to consider the powerful impact of policy choices and voter perception. Trump's immigration crackdown, which has all but eliminated unauthorized border crossings, has also put a dent in the number of available workers. The economy now only needs to create about 80,000 jobs per month to keep unemployment from rising, roughly half the pre-crackdown figure, indicating a tighter labor supply.
Interesting consequence there.
Yeah. Voters' revenge on Harris over economic concerns led to Trump's narrow victory in 2024, and the current economic climate, as described in the article, now directly threatens Republican control of Congress in the 2026 midterms. It highlights a powerful and recurring theme: economic issues shaping electoral outcomes, regardless of who is in power.
Okay, let's take our global tour now, beginning with Trump attacks on judges go global, reaching foreign court systems, revealing a pattern of the White House questioning foreign judiciaries, much like we've seen domestically.
What truly grabbed my attention here is the extension of President Trump's rebukes of judges and courtroom prosecutors beyond U.S. borders, a tactic previously seen within the United States. The most far-reaching example is the administration's July sanctions against a sitting Brazilian Supreme Court justice.
Over the Bolsonaro case.
Exactly, over his role in the case of former President Jair Bolsonaro, a longtime Trump ally who was convicted of attempting a military coup. Deputy Secretary of State Christopher Landau sharply criticized this move as laying waste to the rule of law, highlighting the perceived erosion of international legal norms.
The administration has also expressed concern about freedom of expression in British trials, taking the unusual step of monitoring cases, including that of an anti-abortion protester and a woman sentenced for inciting racial hatred. A British constitutional expert called these moves a gross impertinence and a serious breach of the conventions governing relations between states.
That sounds like strong diplomatic pushback.
It does, underscoring the potential diplomatic fallout when such actions are taken.
Looking at the wider context, experts like Julian Scheinlin, a visiting fellow at Georgetown, suggest that Trump is trying to undermine anything that places limits on what states can do, effectively seeking to remove checks and balances on national leaders, both at home and abroad. This really forces us to consider, what is the impact of a U.S. president's direct challenges to other nations' legal frameworks on international norms and the independence of judicial systems globally? Does it potentially encourage authoritarian tendencies worldwide?
In Trump, before sanctions, NATO must act on Russian oil. We see the president's complex and often contradictory stance on international alliances and sanctions, particularly concerning Russia. It's a tightrope walk that frustrates many allies.
A key takeaway from this piece is Trump's demand that all NATO nations agree to stop buying Russian oil before he's, quote, ready to do major sanctions on Russia. This stance, announced via social media, has critics suggesting it's a tactic to delay any meaningful pressure on Putin, even while many agree that Europe should indeed halt Russian energy imports.
And the article names specific countries still buying.
Yes, it specifically names Turkey, Hungary, and Slovakia as major customers of Russian oil, highlighting the internal divisions within NATO that Trump seems to be leveraging, which complicates presenting a unified front against Russia.
This demand also comes after a very significant security breach. 19 Russian drones flew deep into Polish territory, a NATO member, and some were shot down by NATO military assets.
Right, the first time NATO shot down Russian hardware in NATO airspace.
Exactly. That adds a heightened sense of urgency and concern among European policymakers, especially with Trump's mixed signals on how to handle Russia.
The profound impact here is on the effectiveness and cohesion of international alliances. Trump's mercurial approach to the war in Ukraine, sometimes blasting Putin, sometimes appearing to seek his friendship, frustrates European policymakers, who view Moscow's actions as a major and ongoing security breach. His latest demand, rather than unifying the alliance, is seen by some Russia hawks as simply a way to avoid taking concrete steps against Moscow. This forces us to consider, how effective can alliances be when key members have differing priorities or inconsistent approaches to shared threats?
And then we have how Cambodia became infatuated with Trump, an article about a truly surprising geopolitical shift that seemed to underscore the transactional nature of some foreign policy today.
What's truly remarkable here is Cambodia's notable shift towards the Trump administration, driven partly by the president's perceived disregard for democratic processes and, more directly, by his intervention in a simmering border conflict between Cambodia and Thailand, where he apparently brokered a ceasefire.
So it was a direct intervention that changed things.
That seems to be a major factor. Cambodian officials, like lawmaker Suis Yara, openly express that they see shared values with the U.S. Republican Party and expect Trump to show respect for Cambodia's internal politics, a significant change from previous administrations that often emphasized human rights concerns.
This newfound infatuation has tangible results. It includes resuming joint military drills with the U.S., a tentative visit by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, and even granting a years-old U.S. request for American naval ships to visit Ream Naval Base.
And that base is significant because...
Because U.S. officials previously accused Ream of secretly serving as an overseas outpost for China's military. So allowing U.S. ships there now highlights a complex balancing act in Cambodia's foreign relations, and maybe a potential shift in regional power dynamics.
Looking at the wider context, the article points out that Trump rolled back Biden administration accountability measures, defunding U.S. civil society projects, and even shuttering Voice of America in Cambodia, which had been one of the last remaining news outlets publishing criticism of the ruling party.
So let's focus on democracy promotion.
It seems so. Former opposition politician Musa Shua warns that the U.S. under Trump is about to be thoroughly manipulated by Cambodia. This really forces us to consider, what are the long-term strategic implications of prioritizing transactional relationships and perceived national interest over human rights and democratic values in foreign policy? Does such an approach create more reliable allies or perhaps more vulnerabilities down the line?
From foreign policy, we now look at China's massive infrastructure projects. China, to open world's tallest bridge, expanding infrastructure push, details a truly monumental engineering feat that highlights the nation's ambitious development goals.
A key detail that truly jumped out at me here is the sheer scale of the Huajiang Grand Canyon Bridge. It's so massive, it can fit almost two Eiffel Towers under it, stretching an incredible 9,481 feet end-to-end, almost the length of the National Mall in Washington.
That's hard to even picture.
It really is. Chinese state media is touting this as clear evidence of China's engineering prowess and a new China miracle, emphasizing what they call Gizhou speed and Gizhou wisdom, referring to the mountainous province where it's located. It truly is a testament to their engineering capabilities designed to impress both domestically and globally.
The bridge, which is set to open this month, will drastically cut travel time across the Baipan River from 2 hours to just 2 minutes, connecting previously poorly connected regions in western China. And this isn't an isolated project either, right?
No, not at all. It follows other record-breaking infrastructure achievements, like the world's highest bridge, the Beiponjing Bridge, and the longest bridge spanning the Okhon Ocean, the 22-mile-long Hangzhou Bay Bridge. It's a clear pattern of prioritizing these monumental projects.
A statement, really.
Absolutely. The broader implication here, as Dan Wang, a research fellow at Stanford, explains, is that the Communist Party firmly believes in building enormous projects to boost the economy and burnish political prestige. While engineers express immense pride in these achievements, Wang also notes that this approach often prioritizes these monumental, high-visibility projects over distributing funds directly to the people, raising important questions about economic equity and the allocation of national resources. This truly forces us to consider the balance between national prestige, large-scale economic development, and direct, broad-based societal benefit for its citizens.
Back to the issue of migration and international law, we have a significant story titled, Lawsuit Says U.S. Deported Migrants to Ghana to Sidestep Restrictions. This details some pretty troubling allegations against the Trump administration regarding its handling of asylum seekers.
What's truly striking here is the allegation that the Trump administration unlawfully deported 5 migrants to Ghana. The lawsuit explicitly states this was done to circumvent U.S. legal restrictions against sending them back directly to their home countries, where they faced grave danger. U.S. District Judge Tanya S. Chutkan expressed strong concern, stating that it appeared the administration crafted a deal to make an end run around U.S. legal requirements.
Sort of gaming the system.
That's the allegation. Highlighting a deliberate attempt to bypass established protections for asylum seekers, one of the plaintiffs, a bisexual man from Gambia, where same-sex relationships are criminalized, had actually been granted protection by U.S. judges. Yet, despite this legal safeguard, he was still returned to Gambia without formal processing or valid travel documents after first landing in Ghana, and he remains in hiding in his home country. This situation underscores the direct human cost of these alleged actions.
The profound implication here, as Noah Barron of AKJ, the organization filing the complaint, called it, is a very concerning pattern by the administration of removing people to countries where they have legal protection against return and face grave danger. The legal complaint argues that the administration knows, or reasonably should know, that they will be in grave danger.
A very serious charge.
Extremely. This truly forces us to consider the U.S.'s adherence to its own immigration laws and international protection norms, and the profound ethical implications of such third-country deportation policies that appear to skirt legal and moral obligations.
And across the Atlantic, the Brits, who beat Brexit, Gibraltar back in EU's arms, shows a very different story of shifting borders and relationships, one focused on pragmatism rather than political division.
Yeah, this was a fascinating counterpoint.
What truly grabbed my attention here is the unique outcome for Gibraltarians. 9 years after the UK voted to leave the EU, despite Gibraltar's stringent objections and overwhelming vote to remain, they have found a way back into the EU's embrace. A new treaty will effectively scrap most barriers to travel and trade with Spain, making the historically contentious land border disappear completely and allowing goods to flow freely.
So basically reversing the practical effects of Brexit for them.
Pretty much, yeah. It represents a remarkable turnaround from the initial impacts of Brexit, which left them in a very uncertain position. This comes after nearly a decade in political and economic limbo and years of complex negotiations. Effectively, it makes Gibraltarians the Brits who beat Brexit.
Quite a headline.
It is. The article emphasizes that while they love being British, they had no interest in distancing themselves from Europe, given their physical location on the southern tip of Spain and their deep economic ties to the continent. It highlights a very localized and pragmatic approach to a massive geopolitical decision.
Looking at the wider context, the article highlights Gibraltar's significant economic codependence on Spanish labor. With over 15,000 Spanish nurses, waiters, and construction workers crossing the border daily. This pragmatic approach to border issues, driven by economic necessity, local identity, and a desire for stability, contrasts sharply with the broader, often ideologically driven, Brexit narrative.
It really forces us to consider how local realities and economic interdependence can ultimately redefine national policy and reshape international relationships, even in the face of larger political movements. It's a powerful example of real-world pressures overriding ideological divides.
Okay, now let's turn to technology, starting with a philosophical look at artificial intelligence. The opinion piece, AI Extremists Are Peddling Science Fiction, argues for a much-needed dose of AI realism in current debates.
What truly grabbed my attention here is the author's sharp critique of what they call the doomer-zealot axis that dominates so much of the AI discussion. This axis, the article argues, rests on the false premise that intelligence is a single, linear, measurable thing that machines can one day simply surpass.
The whole singularity idea.
Right. The author asserts that human intelligence, encompassing complex attributes like empathy, judgment, and creativity, is fundamentally undefinable and unmeasurable, making the concept of artificial general intelligence, or AGI, inherently incoherent. They're really pushing back against the idea of a machine truly thinking like a human.
The piece also powerfully debunks the idea that simply adding more GPUs and computational power will automatically summon true intelligence. It calls this a mechanistic worldview that mistakenly equates processing power with wisdom and delivers a memorable line reminding us that AI is no more conscious than a calculator acing an exam. It emphasizes the qualitative difference between computation and consciousness, suggesting we're perhaps anthropomorphizing our machines a bit too much.
The profound implication here is that this call for AI realism advocates for humility, urging us to recognize the immense complexity of human life and the human brain, which we still barely understand. It pushes for a policy focus on investing in infrastructure, talent, and open source frameworks, rather than imposing blanket bans that could stifle legitimate innovation.
So focus on the practical, not the sci-fi.
Basically, yes. This truly forces us to consider, will we meet the advent of AI with paralyzing paranoia or a balanced perspective? And ultimately, harness it as a tool to amplify our human capabilities, rather than treat it as a canvas for either dystopian fears or utopian dreams. It's about managing expectations and directing development responsibly.
And speaking of AI's practical impact, AI's effect on entry-level jobs looks at how it's specifically changing the workforce landscape for young people entering their careers, a topic many are watching closely.
What's truly striking here is the dual impact AI is having on entry-level roles. On one hand, AI is rapidly expediting rote tasks traditionally done by junior workers. Think drafting prospectuses for junior bankers or debugging code for computer scientists.
The grunt work, basically.
Sort of, yeah. A Stanford study found that employment for 22 to 25-year-olds in these highly AI-exposed occupations, like software development and customer service, dropped by a significant 13%, while it actually rose for older workers and those in jobs less exposed to AI. That's a considerable shift in a very short time.
However, for those who are actively using it, AI is proving to be a powerful productivity booster. The article provides compelling examples. A 26-year-old product analyst uses Google Gemini to analyze large data sets in minutes, a task that would have previously taken him 45 minutes manually.
That's a huge time saver.
Huge. Similarly, a 25-year-old auditing senior associate reports that AI cut the time it took to create a flowchart from 6-8 hours down to just 1 minute, enabling her to take on more complex work much earlier in her career. So it seems it's not just about replacing jobs, but really transforming them.
The profound implication here, as experts like Ethan Mollick of the University of Pennsylvania voice, is a significant concern that young workers might lean on AI without gaining experience to evaluate its responses.
Becoming too reliant.
Exactly. This could potentially destroy the traditional apprenticeship experience, where junior colleagues learn critical thinking by observing and actively engaging with senior colleagues' problem-solving processes. He draws a parallel to pilots over-relying on automated systems, which can lead to a critical loss of fundamental skills. This truly forces us to consider, how do education and workplace training need to urgently adapt to ensure young workers develop crucial critical thinking and evaluative skills alongside their proficiency in using AI tools, rather than just becoming, you know, AI operators?
Switching to another area of tech and society, tech worker dissent over Gaza bubbles inside Amazon, Microsoft, and Google shows the internal conflicts and ethical challenges arising within major tech companies regarding geopolitical issues, particularly those with global reach.
What's truly striking here is the increasing frustration among a minority of tech employees, individuals who feel a profound sense of complicity in Israel's policies due to their employers' contracts with the Israeli government and military. The article highlights the case of Amazon software engineer Ahmed Sharur.
He was suspended.
Yes, suspended for calling for Amazon to cut ties with Israel over the Gaza war. Similar situations have unfolded at Microsoft and Google, where employees have been fired for engaging in similar protests, demonstrating a clear crackdown on internal dissent within these powerful corporations.
The article highlights the specifics of these corporate ties, noting Amazon and Google's shared cloud computing project called Nimbus, which serves various Israeli government departments. Microsoft, for its part, provides crucial software and AI services to Israel's Ministry of Defense.
And the Google advertising spending, too.
Right. Google employees also learned this month that Israel's government had posted a document listing $45 million in advertising spending with Google, further intertwining these tech giants with the Israeli government's operations. It paints a picture of deep integration.
The profound implication here is that these incidents reflect a growing and complex ethical challenge for tech companies. They are struggling to balance their commercial interests and contracts with governments against the rising tide of employee activism on highly sensitive geopolitical issues.
Where do you draw the line?
Exactly. This truly forces us to consider, what is the corporate responsibility in an increasingly interconnected world? What are the boundaries of employee free speech in the workplace? And what is the evolving and often controversial role of powerful technology companies in global conflicts and humanitarian crises?
Okay, let's transition to a more personal sphere with Southwest is a favorite for plus-size flyers. A new policy may change that, a shift that could affect a lot of travelers.
What's fascinating here is Southwest's change to a long-standing and frankly quite generous policy that had accommodated plus-size passengers by refunding or providing extra seats for free if needed. Effective January 27th, a second seat on a sold-out flight will no longer be eligible for a refund.
So if the flight's full, you pay for two seats.
That's the implication. Advocates say this could be a prohibitive expense and force many to stop flying altogether. It's a big shift from their previous customer of size policy.
This change aligns Southwest more closely with competitors, but it's timed with its move from open seating to assigned seating.
Another perk many valued.
Right, another feature valued by plus-size travelers for autonomy and seat selection. And Southwest also terminated its two free checked bags perk for flights booked after May 28th, a significant loss for those whose clothes might require more space. Seems like a general tightening up.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this policy shift, while aiming to align with industry standards, has significant implications for accessibility and inclusivity in air travel. It raises an important question about the balance between airline profitability and the needs of diverse passenger groups. And will this lead to a broader industry reevaluation of accommodation for plus-size travelers, or is it just Southwest falling in line?
Staying with travel, what to know about Touchless ID, which uses facial recognition at TSA, explores a new security measure rolling out at airports.
What's fascinating here is the voluntary TSA pre-check touchless ID system. It uses facial recognition technology to potentially speed travelers through security checkpoints. How it works is it matches a live facial image taken at the checkpoint against pre-staged photos from, say, passports or visas, leveraging the CBP Traveler Verification Service.
So no need to show your ID?
Potentially, yes. The program is available at 15 major U.S. airports, including Reagan National right here in D.C. Users need to be PreCheck members with a known traveler number, an active airline profile, and a valid passport uploaded. While promising faster screening, critics, unsurprisingly, worry about data misuse and privacy.
Always the concern with facial recognition.
Always. If we connect this to the broader picture, this represents a significant step towards biometrically-based travel. It raises important questions about privacy, data security, and the trade-off between convenience and potential surveillance. While voluntary for now, it's part of a larger trend towards touchless, data-driven identification in public spaces. Something to watch.
Now for personal finance. Inflation is relentless. Here are five ways to help you ride it out, a topic many are feeling right now.
What's fascinating here is the persistence of inflation. Consumer prices rose 0.4% last month, pushing the annual rate to 2.9%. This stubborn creep in housing, grocery, and gas prices is making millions pessimistic, especially those living paycheck to paycheck. It just keeps grinding on.
The advice focuses on practical steps. Cutting easier to drop expenses, like dining out the food away from home index is up 3.9%, so that's noticeable. Auditing grocery spending, scrutinizing entertainment subscriptions. It also emphasizes the importance of an emergency fund, even small amounts, as a safety net. Pretty standard advice, but maybe more urgent now.
Right. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the article highlights the need for a monthly budget review to catch overspending and adapt to new costs, like those associated with returning to the office, or RTO for many people. It raises an important question about financial resilience in an unstable economic environment and the importance of proactive personal financial management. You really have to stay on top of it.
And work advice. How long is too long to wait for my company's 401k match? Also, is it safe to reveal that I have a disability on a job application? This column gives us two common workplace dilemmas.
What's fascinating here is the insight into 401k true-ups. While a reader was getting anxious waiting for a $6,000 match promised back in January, experts note that companies typically have until the tax filing deadline March 15th, or even October 15th with extensions, plus 30 additional days to actually complete the match contribution for the previous year.
So waiting until November isn't necessarily unusual.
Apparently not. It's not unheard of, which might surprise some people. The second question addresses disability disclosure on job applications. The columnist, Carla Miller, notes that most applicant tracking systems are programmed to segregate demographic data from the actual application materials for government reporting purposes.
Meaning the hiring manager doesn't see it initially.
That's the idea. If we connect this to the broader picture, well, the line about this won't affect hiring decisions isn't just fluff, it's the law. There's still understandably a lingering concern for applicants. The advice suggests it's generally safe to disclose, but opting out and discussing accommodations later once a job offer is extended is also a perfectly valid option. It raises an important question about trust in HR systems and the practicalities of anti-discrimination laws versus applicant comfort levels.
Moving to community and connection, we have a unique local story from the Metro section, No Phones Allowed. This article is about Hush Harbor, a new phone-free bar in DC aiming to foster genuine human interaction.
What truly grabbed my attention here is Chef Ramen Rock, Harper's very deliberate vision to revive what he calls the magic of being present with people, drawing inspiration from 90s-era go-go culture where conversation and direct engagement were paramount.
How does it work? They take your phone.
Yeah. Guests at Hush Harbor are required to lock up their phones in yonder pouches, sometimes even worn as crossbody bags. Polaroid cameras and playing cards are offered as analog alternatives to encourage unmediated interaction. It's a bold move in our hyper-connected world.
The name Hush Harbor itself is rich with meaning, referencing historical protected community gathering places for African Americans, underscoring the bar's intention as a safe space for connection and refuge. It's a place with very little social media presence, which is rare these days.
Which is part of the point, I guess.
Exactly. Yet, word still managed to spread, as evidenced by a food critic TikTok about not being able to take photos inside, which then generated a wave of comments about people needing a wellness check after 5 hours offline. It perfectly illustrates how ingrained our phone habits have become.
The broader implication here is that this innovative initiative speaks to a growing societal desire for a digital detox and authentic human connection in an increasingly online-dominated world. The anecdote of a groom at a bachelor party instinctively reaching for his phone to photograph unique wallpaper, only to realize he had to describe it instead.
Ah, yeah, that was telling.
Perfectly illustrates the deeply ingrained habits Harper is trying to break. This truly forces us to consider, What is our evolving relationship with technology, the constant pull of the digital world, and our collective capacity for unmediated in-person social interaction? Are we losing something crucial by being constantly connected?
In a different vein of community engagement, National Guard cleans Ward 8 locale, details an effort to build trust in D.C. after recent deployments.
What's fascinating here is the D.C. National Guard offering to help with community cleanups in Anacostia, a historically underserved area. This comes after 2,300 National Guard troops were deployed in D.C. following President Trump's crime emergency declaration, leading to understandable resident distrust of a militarized presence.
Right. The context is key.
Absolutely. While some advisory neighborhood commissions voted against the Guard's presence, ANC 8B accepted the offer. Commissioner Joseph Johnson saw it as an opportunity to bridge the gap and clarify that the troops were coming unarmed to clean, not police. Making that distinction was important.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this initiative attempts to counter negative perceptions of federal intervention by demonstrating community service, distinguishing itself from federal law enforcement agencies, which residents often view with more apprehension. This raises an important question about how institutions can rebuild trust in communities that feel targeted or over-policed, and the symbolic power of acts of service, even seemingly small ones.
All right, time for some culture. How many ways can you enjoy ABBA in 2025? I was Bjorn to find out. Delves into the enduring phenomenon of the Swedish pop group. Still going strong.
What's truly remarkable here is ABBA's immense and varied presence in 2025, over 50 years after Waterloo. We have Mamma Mia back on Broadway, and a third film reportedly on the way. In London, fans can experience Mamma Mia, The Party, an immersive dine and dance experience.
I heard about that.
Or be enchanted by the ABBA Voyage digital avatars, which are drawing 20,000 fans a week to a cutting-edge digital concert. It's a multi-platform empire that continues to grow and innovate.
The article offers a vibes-based appraisal of these experiences, and the reviewer has some interesting takes. While ABBA Voyage is praised for crystallizing the band's legacy, the reviewer finds it somewhat sterile, lacking the messiness of life that ABBA's songs are often about.
That's an interesting critique.
Yeah, the critic even questions whom to clap for when the performers are essentially holograms, which is a very interesting point about the nature of live performance today and our emotional connection to it.
If we connect this to the broader picture, ABBA's sustained popularity across such diverse media, from traditional musicals and films to cutting-edge digital concerts, highlights the incredible power of iconic music and sheer nostalgia to transcend generations and technological advancements. It shows how their appeal has endured and adapted. This truly forces us to consider, what is the future of live entertainment? How will technology continue to redefine the concert experience? And what truly constitutes an authentic performance when the artists themselves are digital avatars?
Next, Jude Law is a star with the element of surprise, offers a profile of the versatile actor, looking at his recent career choices.
What's fascinating here is Jude Law's uncanny malleability as an actor, now at 52. In the past year alone, he's portrayed a world-weary FBI agent, a conniving space pirate, a surly philosopher, and even Russian President Vladimir Putin in the upcoming film The Wizard of the Kremlin.
Quite a range.
Absolutely. Next, he'll play a glad-handing Manhattan restaurateur in Black Rabbit. The article highlights his daring choices beyond just matinee idol roles, taking on anti-heroes and antagonists, and his increasing involvement behind the camera with his production company, Riff Raff Entertainment, which aims to, quote, tell me something I don't know.
If we connect this to the broader picture, Law's trajectory reflects a shift in Hollywood, where actors increasingly seek control over their careers through production. His upcoming role as Putin, aiming for an award season release, demonstrates the powerful intersection of art and geopolitics, and raises an important question about how public figures use their platform to comment on world events through their creative choices.
Then, Show of Modern Art from Iraq Reveals Cultural Costs of War brings us to a significant art exhibition, shedding light on a lesser-known aspect of Iraq's history and the devastating impact of conflict on a nation's identity.
What's truly striking here is the exhibition All Manner of Experiments, Legacies of the Baghdad Mahdi Art Group at Bard College. It showcases Iraq's vibrant 20th century art, an aspect often overshadowed by its ancient heritage. Crucially, the exhibition also directly addresses the enormous loss of cultural heritage from the 2003 U.S. invasion.
When so much was lost from the museum.
Exactly. When an estimated 15,000 objects, including thousands of 20th century artworks, were stolen or disappeared from its National Museum of Modern Art, with many still unrecovered or damaged, it's a stark reminder of what's lost in war beyond human lives.
The exhibition attempts to reconstruct this significant art movement despite so many missing works, using an archival-heavy approach that includes photographs, historical archives, and publications. It features key artists like Jewad Salim, whose Children's Games blends Cubist elements with Islamic and Mesopotamian imagery.
Beautiful work.
And Hana Malala, whose Abstract Yet Powerful, The Two Worshippers from 1989, uncannily presages the 2003 devastation, adding a poignant layer of foresight to the collection.
If we connect this to the broader picture, this exhibition profoundly underscores the cultural costs of war, which extend far beyond immediate human casualties and physical destruction. It also provides a vital model for documenting and preserving art from regions ravaged by conflict, drawing parallels to ongoing efforts in places like Ukraine and Gaza. This truly forces us to consider, what is the enduring role of art in shaping national identity and collective memory? And what is the long-term, often irreparable impact of cultural destruction on societies long after the immediate conflict itself has ended?
And finally, in arts, I was a Hollow Knight skeptic, now I see it's a masterpiece, introduces us to a beloved indie video game from a critic's perspective.
What's fascinating here is the critic's journey from skepticism to admiration for the 2017 indie game Hollow Knight. The game's bravery in storytelling is highlighted. It trusts the player to find purpose in a seemingly monotone, dead world with an empty-eyed protagonist. Not a lot of hand-holding.
Like some classic games.
Exactly. Like Metroid and the Souls games, it tells its story largely through environment and gameplay rather than explicit narrative dumps. The critic describes how the player, by filling out the knight's existence and acquiring new abilities, gradually solves existential mysteries, leading to an extraordinary and fulfilling climax.
If we connect this to the broader picture, the article highlights how video games can be a uniquely rewarding way to experience a narrative, demonstrating a genre that challenges players to actively engage with discovery and purpose, rather than being passively told a story. This raises an important question about the evolving artistic and narrative potential of the video game medium itself.
Okay, let's transition to the wide world of sports, starting with baseball. In a game of feet and inches, the Nationals come up short versus Pirates, reports on a recent, apparently frustrating game for the home team.
What's fascinating here is how close the game was described, a few feet or inches, deciding the 5-1 loss. Key plays included an Andrew McCutchen sinking liner that outfielder Dylan Cruz pulled up on, thinking it might be caught, only for it to drop at his feet and score 2 runs.
Ouch.
Yeah, and a grounder bouncing off second baseman Luis Garcia Jr.'s glove for 2 more runs. Just those small moments changing everything.
Despite the loss, the Nationals rookie pitcher Andrew Alvarez had an impressive outing. He allowed no runs, only 3 hits in 6 innings, achieving the second lowest ERA among rookies after 3 starts in team history. The article notes he relies on command and mixing pitches, not just velocity.
So a bright spot in the loss.
Definitely. If we connect this to the broader picture, it illustrates the fine margins in professional sports, where small defensive miscalculations or lucky bounces can entirely swing a game, overshadowing individual strong performances like Alvarez's. This raises an important question about the role of chance versus skill in determining outcomes and the mental resilience required in a game like baseball.
Switching to football, Maryland routes Towson in non-conference finale, but tougher tests await. Covers local college football action.
What's fascinating here is Maryland's dominant 44-17 victory, moving them to 3-0. Freshman quarterback Malik Washington had a strong performance, accounting for 290 total yards and 2 touchdowns. The defense also shined, collecting 2 takeaways, 3 sacks, and allowing 0 first-half points for the first time this season, including a 100-yard interception return for a touchdown by safety Glendon Miller.
Sounds like a solid win.
Very solid. Coach Michael Loxley praised the team's strong finish to their non-conference schedule. However, the article also notes, as the headline suggests, that tougher tests await as they enter Big Ten play against Wisconsin next weekend, and potentially facing their former starting quarterback, Billy Edwards Jr., who transferred there.
Ah, the storyline writes itself.
Exactly. If we connect this to the broader picture, this game, while a clear victory, serves primarily as a tune-up for the much more competitive conference play, where the true measure of a team's strength is revealed. It raises an important question about building momentum in early season games versus facing the challenges of significantly stronger opposition.
In the NFL, The electric chief's offense is gone, and it might not come back, presents a pretty sobering assessment of the reigning champs.
What's fascinating here is the description of the Chiefs' offense as shockingly reliant on quarterback Patrick Mahomes playing hero ball. The team has been struggling to consistently score 20 points in many weeks, and their running game apparently couldn't get out of neutral in their season opening loss, not the high-flying Chiefs we're used to.
The article notes that their red zone touchdown rate has significantly sagged. From leading the NFL at 64.4% between 2021 and 2023, down to 26th at 51.3% since late 2023. That's a big drop.
Huge drop. They attribute this partly to multipurpose running back Jerick McKinnon's injury problems, which limited a key weapon for them in scoring situations.
If we connect this to the broader picture, despite having a generational talent in Mahomes and an expert coach in Andy Reid, the team's offensive identity has clearly shifted, at least temporarily, relying more on defense and special teams. This raises an important question about how even the most dominant teams adapt when key elements of their strategy or personnel change, and the fleeting nature of mystique or perceived invincibility in professional sports.
Locally, returning to tradition, Westfield is 3-0 for the first time since 2019, covers high school football success.
What's fascinating here is Westfield High's return to form, achieving a 3-hour record for the first time in 6 years, capped by a comprehensive 24-6 victory over Lake Braddock. The article notes the team is benefiting from undefeated freshman and junior varsity squads in previous years coming up through the ranks.
Building that pipeline.
Exactly. They forced 4 turnovers and secured 2 fourth-quarter touchdowns in the win. Coach Keith Vossler emphasized honoring the Westfield tradition of competing with top teams, referencing their 3 consecutive state titles from 2015 to 2017. The article highlights the roles of senior leaders and growing underclassmen in this resurgence.
If we connect this to the broader picture, this story illustrates the cyclical nature of high school sports programs, where sustained success relies heavily on developing young talent and maintaining a strong team culture over time. It raises an important question about the long-term investment in youth sports feeder programs and its impact on community pride and school spirit.
Back to the pros. DC United settles for draw against Orlando after second-half red card, discusses recent MLS soccer action.
What's fascinating here is DC United's ability to salvage a 1-1 draw against the league's top offensive team, Orlando City, despite playing with only 10 men for over 40 minutes due to a red card issued to midfielder Mateus Klisch. Jackson Hopkins provided a first-half lead for United.
So they held on despite being down a player.
They did. The team's unbeaten streak under new coach Rene Weiler continues through his first 4 matches, with players noting his role in changing our mentality. The match apparently saw a lengthy VAR review for the red card, adding 8 minutes of stoppage time, ultimately extending the game to 100 minutes.
If we connect this to the broader picture, this result, despite DC United being out of playoff contention, shows resilience and a positive shift in team mentality under new leadership, potentially building momentum for the next season. It raises an important question about the psychological impact of coaching changes and how teams find purpose and motivation even when the season's primary goals are out of reach.
In track and field, at Worlds, Sha'Carri and Lyles feel they found something among those long-awaited cheers in Tokyo, focuses on 2 top American sprinters at the World Athletics Championships.
What's fascinating here is the comeback narrative for Sha'Carri Richardson and Noah Lyles. Both are defending world champions in the 100 meters, and both won their preliminary heats, finding, as the article says, what's been missing over a less-than-perfect 2025, amidst a loud sellout crowd in Tokyo, a different atmosphere than the last Olympics there.
Definitely. Lyles, who hadn't cracked 9.9 seconds this year, felt he unlocked something in practice, realizing he was tightening his muscles unnecessarily. Richardson, slowed by injury earlier in the season, achieved her season-best time of 11.03 seconds despite a slow start out of the block, stating, "Sometimes you've got to dig through the dirt to get to the gold."
If we connect this to the broader picture, the article highlights the importance of mental and physical adjustments for elite athletes, especially when battling injuries, and the immense pressure of expectation. The return of a cheering crowd in Tokyo after the COVID-tainted Olympics underscores the crucial role of fan energy in athletic performance and the shared experience of major sporting events. This raises an important question about resilience, self-discovery, and the power of external motivation in competitive sports.
Okay, let's shift to some significant developments in women's sports. How much are WNBA players worth? The league's future lies in the answer. Delves into the critical ongoing negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement, or CBA.
What's truly striking here is the high-stakes negotiation, with the current deal set to expire next month. Players are adamantly demanding a 50-50 split of league revenue, citing what they describe as a successful season marked by higher ratings, booming merchandise sales, and exploding expansion franchise fees.
Those fees are incredible now.
They really are jumping from $2 million in 2021 to a reported $250 million recently for new teams in Portland and Denver. Players are clearly seeing the growth and want to share equitably in it.
On the other side, owners argue that expenses eat up a higher percentage of revenue in the WNBA than in bigger, more established leagues, leading to their desire for a less than 50-50 split. The players' union president, Anika Agwumaike, states that the system has to reflect that of growth with the business, underscoring the players' belief that their compensation should align with the league's undeniable growth and increasing value.
If we connect this to the broader picture, the dispute highlights transparency issues, with the union alleging that the NBA, which owns a controlling stake in the WNBA, isn't being fully transparent with the Women's League's finances. Economists like Claudia Golden argue the WNBA's new media rights deal, valued at $200 million per year, up significantly from $60 million, was actually undervalued by being negotiated simultaneously with the NBA, suggesting it didn't reflect the league's true independent market worth.
So they might have left money on the table.
That's the argument. This truly forces us to consider, what constitutes equitable compensation in rapidly growing women's sports? What are the underlying power dynamics within professional leagues, especially when one league is linked to a much larger one? And what are the challenges of accurately valuing burgeoning assets in this kind of complex structure?
And finally, we have an important debate in sports ethics, the ethical considerations of being a football fan. This is a collection of reader letters providing diverse viewpoints on a complex and often uncomfortable issue for many.
What's truly striking here is the deep internal conflict many fans feel. Readers like Fred Small and Marie Wells express a profound love for the game, often linked to cherished family memories, but they candidly acknowledge the especially cruel physical and mental consequences for players, particularly chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE.
The brain disease.
Right, the degenerative brain disease. Marie, for example, describes her dissonance as she eagerly anticipates the new NFL season, despite her awareness of the devastating harm caused to players. It's a very personal and relatable struggle for many fans, I think.
On the other hand, Dave Gentsch and Paul Babiarz present a different argument, asserting that professional players are paid millions of dollars, know the risks involved, and participate in the sport by their own volition. They draw parallels to soldiers or firefighters, suggesting that the inherent dangers are simply part of the job that players willingly undertake, and therefore fans aren't necessarily culpable.
They chose this argument.
Essentially, yes. If we connect this to the broader picture, Peter McFerrin's letter notes his decision to stop watching 15 years ago due to the damage to players' brains, and he highlights the incredibly slim chance of high school players ever making it to the NFL, despite families risking their sons' futures. Michael Chiarito stopped watching after learning that 110 out of 111 deceased NFL players studied had CTE.
That statistic is just brutal.
It is. This collection of letters truly forces us to consider, what is the balance between individual responsibility and choice versus systemic ethical concerns in sports? And can the sport truly evolve to mitigate these severe risks without losing its inherent appeal? Or do fans bear a moral responsibility in their consumption of the game? Heavy questions with no easy answers.
Also in sports, though it's not a full article, just a mention in the business section, is a piece titled Fanatics. This discusses the business practices of a major sports merchandising and trading card company that's been growing rapidly.
What's fascinating here is a controversy surrounding Fanatics' aggressive growth. Panini, a competitor in the trading card space, alleges that Fanatics used parasitic methods to gain dominance, including buying a printing company crucial to Panini's operations and allegedly reducing Panini's supply of player jerseys and autographs needed for their cards. They even accuse Fanatics of trying to hire away Panini's CEO.
Sounds like hardball tactics.
Very much so. Mark Edelman, a sports law professor quoted, expresses concern that Fanatics has also sold shares of its company to the major American sports leagues and players' associations themselves and has locked up exclusive 10 to 20 year licenses for trading cards. This makes it, in his words, nearly impossible for any other company to make official cards for a generation.
Creating a potential monopoly.
That's the concern raised. If we connect this to the broader picture, this situation raises an important question about fair competition and potential monopolistic practices in the lucrative sports merchandising industry. The implications could extend to consumers who might see less choice and potentially higher prices if one company essentially controls the market for official licensed products across multiple sports.
From sports, let's explore some thought-provoking books reviewed in the post. We start with Our Stubborn Constitution, a review of Jill Lepore's new book, We the People.
What's fascinating here is Lepore's central argument that the difficulty and rarity of amending the U.S. Constitution have made it sclerotic, stifling popular will, and making it nearly impossible to tackle deeply entrenched problems in modern society. The delegates back in 1787 sought a sweet spot between mutability and intractability in Article V, the amendment process.
But Lepore argues they missed.
Yes, she argues it was saddled with the three most fateful compromises of the convention: protecting the slave trade, granting disproportionate power to small states and slave states in the Senate, and making equal suffrage in the Senate virtually unamendable. These compromises, she says, baked in rigidities.
She notes that while the founding generation ratified a multitude of amendments relatively quickly, only 15 more have been added in the 221 years since the Bill of Rights, out of nearly 12,000 formally introduced. That's a tiny success rate.
Really tiny. She attributes this increasing difficulty partly to unforeseeable factors like the rise of entrenched political parties and intense polarization, making the supermajority requirements for amendments almost impossible to meet today.
If we connect this to the broader picture, the review praises Lepore for unearthing long-ignored contributions from excluded groups, like African-American constitutional conventions promoting black citizenship, which later influenced the 14th Amendment. However, it also points out the Constitution's successful track record compared to other nations. It is the world's oldest written constitution still in force.
So there's a tension there.
Exactly. This raises an important question about the balance between stability and adaptability in foundational legal documents. Mm-hmm. Do modern challenges demand a serious reevaluation of its amendment process, or is that stability its greatest strength, even if frustrating at times?
Then there's The Gods of New York draws a line from the late 1980s to now, reviewing Jonathan Mahler's new book about a pivotal era in New York City.
What's fascinating here is Mahler's chronicle of New York City specifically from 1986 to 1990, a period he describes as febrile years marked by stark economic inequality, rampant homelessness, intense racial tension, and political corruption. He profiles figures who dominated that era.
Many still familiar names.
Exactly. Figures like Donald Trump, Rudy Giuliani, Reverend Al Sharpton, and filmmaker Spike Lee, arguing that many remain familiar today and that this specific era, alchemically mixed with tabloid culture and growing veneration of wealth, really shaped the present.
Mahler suggests that Trump as president is a pure product of this chaotic, polarized, every man for himself, tabloid-driven 1980s New York, acquiring power through what Mahler characterizes as deceit, shamelessness, and chutzpah. The book also recalls Sharpton's moment of greatest infamy in 1987 with the Tawana Brawley case, where his actions were heavily criticized for neglecting facts in favor of racial grievance.
If we connect this to the broader picture, the book positions the Ed Cooke mayoral years and wider societal forces of that time as laying the groundwork for a more individualistic and unequal New York, and by extension, perhaps, the current national political landscape. This raises an important question about the long-term echoes of past urban and political dynamics on present-day society and leadership styles. How much of today was forged back then?
Also reviewed, whistleblower reality winner is out of prison and speaking out, sort of, discussing her memoir, I Am Not Your Enemy.
What's fascinating here is Winner's memoir tackling really big questions about government secrecy, media protection of sources, and the application of the Espionage Act. She recounts her thoughts at the time she leaked classified documents about Russian election interference. This is going to be big. Maybe help save this country. And nobody will ever know it was me. Famous last words, obviously.
Obviously. Okay. She describes feeling betrayed by the clumsy way The Intercept, the news outlet she leaked to, handled the document, which ultimately led directly to her arrest. The review notes the most compelling parts are verbatim transcriptions of her FBI interrogation and jail calls, which reveal the raw and compelling authenticity of her experience.
If we connect this to the broader picture, Winner's story, including her punitive 5-year sentence, much harsher than sentences given to some higher-ranking officials for mishandling classified information, raises an important question about potential double standards in the justice system regarding leaks. It highlights the challenges whistleblowers face and the difficult balance between national security imperatives and the public's right to know in a democracy.
And finally, a justice tells us what she's thinking. review Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett's new book, Listening to the Law.
What's fascinating here is the reviewer's argument that Justice Amy Coney Barrett is potentially the most important justice on the Supreme Court today due to her often decisive swing vote, frequently positioned between the court's conservative and liberal wings. The book positions her as the most faithful heir to the late Justice Antonin Scalia's judicial philosophy of originalism and textualism.
Trying to stick to the text.
Right. Striving to decide cases purely on the basis of what the law says, without regard to any preference for a specific outcome. She explicitly addresses the challenge of ignoring ideological preferences and public approval or disapproval, citing historical examples of justices who were widely hated for their decisions but stuck to their interpretation of the law. This self-schooling is seen by the reviewer as a key to her sometimes centrist outcomes in high-profile cases.
If we connect this to the broader picture, the review subtly suggests that perhaps other conservative justices might be cheating, in the Stalian sense, by allowing their policy preferences to influence their decisions, deviating from a pure textualist approach. This raises an important question about judicial integrity, the consistent application of stated legal philosophies, and the perception of partisanship on the Supreme Court at a critical juncture for the rule of law in the country.
And the Post also briefly mentioned several other notable books. There's Leni Zuma's novel Wolf Bells, about a community of castoffs, Mick Herron's new spy novel Clown Town, known for its gritty perspective on spycraft. Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, argues in This Is For Everyone that we can recapture the web's democratic roots from its current state.
Which he describes as a cesspool of cruelty. Strong words from the founder.
Indeed. There's also Karen Palmer's memoir, she's under here, recounting her escape from an abusive ex-husband by changing her identity. Elizabeth Gilbert's All the Way to the River, a memoir about a troubled partnership with a drug addict. Stephen Greenblatt's Dark Renaissance explores Christopher Marlowe's life. And of course, mentions of upcoming fall releases and current bestsellers. Quite a literary landscape covered.
Wow, Lee, that was an incredibly dense and illuminating deep dive into the Washington Post for Sunday, September 14th, 2025. We've covered everything from the political currents shaping our nation and the world to the quiet personal struggles and triumphs in technology, daily life, and the arts.
Indeed, that was comprehensive, and it really brought home the interconnectedness of our world. What stands out to me today is the pervasive sense that the familiar ground beneath our feet is continually shifting. Whether it's the evolving nature of political discourse and its violent undercurrents, the economic anxieties felt by everyday Americans contrasted with a booming stock market.
That disconnect, yeah.
Or the ethical dilemmas posed by new technologies
yeah.
and changing social norms. We've seen how deeply interconnected these issues are, locally and globally. It suggests a world in constant negotiation, from national borders to personal ethics.
Absolutely. And for you, our listener, what stands out to you? As we navigate a world where every issue, from the global rights reaction to an activist's death to the ethical considerations of being a football fan, seems to be a complex litmus test, how do we, as individuals, find our footing? How do we discern genuine insight from noise, hold on to our values, and contribute meaningfully to a public discourse that feels increasingly polarized and personal?
It's an important question, one that resonates across so many of the stories we have explored. The common thread in so many of these articles is the tension between deeply held beliefs, powerful societal pressures, and the individual's role in a rapidly changing environment. It challenges us to think critically about the narratives we consume, the sources we trust, and the actions we take, both personally and civically, to shape the kind of world we want to live in.
Ultimately, perhaps the deepest dive is into our own capacity for understanding and empathy in these turbulent times.
A truly provocative thought to mull over. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst. Until next time, stay curious and keep seeking those deeper insights.